I'm Jim Wills, and this is the Art Unknown Podcast, where we feed your soul with art.
Art enriches our lives. It can transform people in a moment of deep need.
Art is here after we're gone, but art also documents culture, and art is our culture.
To me, art is a way of life, and it's the way of the curious, it's the way of the search.
It's how we express ourselves. That's how we're able to connect with people. It's how we're able to understand a bit more about ourselves.
There's no secret recipe to how you find success. It's simply not giving up.
Today on the podcast, I am very excited to talk to this gentleman. I think we've walked similar paths in our lives, and we're in the same age range, and his topic of expertise is my childhood. So, I'm with Chris Orcutt, and Chris Orcutt was born in Maine, lived in New England, Massachusetts, New York. More importantly, he has been a journalist for newspaper magazines, a school teacher, a college teacher, and has been a writer most of his professional life. Has also done some speech writing, and he's written a bunch of published work, but he's recently written a tale called Bodaciously True and Totally Awesome. It is 9 books spread across 2 years of the 1980s, which again is my childhood. So I am so excited to talk to Chris Orcutt. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here, Jim. It's a pleasure.
I know that was a pretty long intro just because.
No, I appreciate it. It's great to, I'm kind of sitting back here like, wow, who is this guy that's done all this stuff?
I've done all that cool shit. That's
what?
So Chris, I start off every episode with an inspiration, something that inspires you, that you carry with you. Question to you.
All right. So you mean, would you think a quote or a talisman, something that I carry around with me, or
yeah, sure, a quote, a book, a talisman. I love that. Whatever you got, a child.
Well, I snuck a chestnut in through customs from Paris, and because I read in Hemingway's A Movable Feast, him talking about the chestnut trees on this island in the Seine, and also in the Jardin de Luxembourg. And so I got a chestnut from each place, and I snuck them into the U.S., you know, if customs wants to come and arrest me, I just deny that I have them. But I snuck them through. And they've always been inspirational to me because, you know, it's like having a little piece of that book, which was really inspiring for me. I read that as a teenager, and I was like, I've got to get to Paris someday. But I, you know, as far as if you want a quote that's really been inspirational for me, in the background here, I've got a little whiteboard, and on it, I wrote a few quotes, you know, years ago during the writing of Bodaciously. And one that has always given me inspiration is by Nelson Mandela, who said, "It always seems impossible until it's done." Because there were many, many days, Jim, during the writing of Bodaciously, we're talking 10 years here, 10 years that I basically isolated myself to do this. I stayed off the internet. I wasn't involved with social media. I didn't listen to the radio. I didn't watch TV. I know it sounds nuts, but I really tried to immerse myself in the 1980s so I could just absorb the zeitgeist. I only listened to music from the 80s. I mean, I went hardcore into this. And there were many days when I was just like, Jesus, Chris, what you're doing is impossible. And I would come into my office and I would read that quote. It always seems impossible until it's done. And I'm looking forward to November or December of 2027 when all 9 books will be out and I'll be able to say that it's done. And I think a lot of people would say, I mean, I've thought it many times, that what I'm doing at first blush is impossible, but I'm doing it. And that quote has gotten me through for a long time.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's, you give us a lot here just in a couple of minutes.
Oh, okay.
I have to say that the Hemingway chestnuts are the most original inspiration I have gotten in 80 plus episodes of this podcast.
Oh, wow. So, that's a, you know, I mean, I've got a lot of little talismans and stuff around here, but those chestnuts, man, I'm so proud of the fact that I had the courage, because, you know, it's got the signs up, you know, it's like, you better not bring fruit, seeds, anything. And I was like, damn it. I don't care, man. I don't care. I'm taking these chestnuts home because it's just a piece of that experience.
Wow. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I have a piece of basalt rock, you know, volcanic rock from Bali, and that one of the artists in Bali that I interviewed gave to me. And it's only, it was just a rock. So I'm sure that that's not a big deal at customs, but still, I didn't think twice. Like when I put it in my suitcase, I'm taking this home. I didn't think twice about any of that stuff. So
there is something to a physical reminder of a place.
Yes.
It's like you put your hand out, you touch the thing, and you're not just touching the place, you're touching the past. You know, I've got a rock too. I've got one from, I really probably shouldn't say this, but you know, they tell you not to take, you know, I took a very small stone from Little Round Top, where the 20th Maine at Gettysburg held the line, et cetera, refused the line. But I have a very small stone that I got from the ground. You know, I didn't dig anything, but you touch that thing and it's like you're touching a little piece of history. So I've got a number of those.
Well, yeah, that's wow. I lived in Colorado for many years and I would climb to Colorado as the 14ers. Mountains are 14,000 feet. I used to take a rock from the top of the 14er every time I'd summit one. And
well, you put all that work into it, you better get something out of it, man.
But it's the same. It's totally illegal to do it. So I'll deny it.
Is it?
Well, I don't know how illegal. I mean, the Park Service doesn't like it.
Well, when you think about it, everybody who went to the top of Everest took a damn rock, that thing would be like 100 feet shorter than it is, right?
It's right,
like
9,028
feet, and you know, it'd be like 28,000 something feet.
I lose the title. And same in the Rockies. If someone took a rock from the Stone Ferry Peak, it would no longer be 14ers, probably. I don't know. But
wow,
it's I agree. Having these sort of like you said, talismans, these little trinkets. So it's nice to have that around as a reminder of places you've been, experiences you've had, which segue is kind of what your latest project is all about. If you will, give us your story a little bit more about, and then we'll flip around to the Nelson Mandela quote. But give us your story of working in the arts as a writer, if you will.
Well, I've always been a writer. I started writing when I was 13 years old. I read a copy of Ian Fleming's Goldfinger. And as soon as I read it, I just fell in love with the language. I fell in love with the way he communicated the ideas, how eloquent he was in, you know, telling a James Bond spy tale. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. And in college, I studied philosophy. I, you know, took some literature courses, et cetera, but I'm basically self-taught. I say basically, I'm self-taught as a fiction writer. And after college, I worked for newspapers and did some corporate speech writing and, you know, the script writing, technical writing. Mm-hmm. And I did that until 9/11. And when 9/11 came along, my wife really encouraged me. She was like, look, you know, life is short. And I worked right across the street from the Twin Towers on 9/11. I was working for Merrill Lynch doing communications, corporate communications. And my wife was like, look, your heart isn't in this. You hate it. Of course, 9/11 was traumatizing. Fortunately, I wasn't there. I was on my way into the city. Just a week before, I had changed my hours to go in an hour later. And so I was on the train going into the city when the first plane hit and came out of Grand Central into total pandemonium. I mean, Fifth Avenue was just, it was just crazy. And I'll never forget a couple of images. One was a man, this bald man. He was middle-aged. He was a manager at one of the financial companies in the Trade Center. And I'll never forget him saying, I have my people down there. And he rushes out of the train. And I'm telling you, Jim, never saw him again.
Wow.
Never saw him on the train again. I think he bought it. I think he bought it down there, rushing down into the maelstrom. And the other image that I'll never forget was getting out to Fifth Avenue. My wife and I met at the New York Public Library. That was the place we had always chosen to meet if there was ever an emergency. And I saw a fireman on a fire truck speeding down Fifth Avenue and basically holding onto the back of the fire engine and kind of waving to the crowd. And I don't think that guy made it. You know, it was a really, really terrible day. My wife and I ended up having to hike out of Manhattan. We had to hike those 14 miles north out of Manhattan to get to a bridge where we could finally get out at the very tip. And a friend of mine picked me up. Okay, that's the 9/11. That's the 9/11 detour. But the point was with 9/11 was that my wife was like, look, you need to focus on your fiction writing. And that's when I started to really focus on my fiction writing. And that's when I was doing things like to earn extra money. I was teaching at Baruch College, that's City University in New York, and doing speech writing, and which brings me to today.
When did the idea of Bodaciously True come into your mind?
It was actually 10 years ago this month.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you have been working
exactly
on this
10 years later. And it was December 2015, probably a little bit before that. It was actually maybe the first glimmers of it started in the summer of 2015. And I think they started, Jim, because I was feeling a little nostalgic. I was 45 years old at the time, you know, the midlife thing. And I was, you know, it was pretty damn good back then, you know, and I was trying to process, I was feeling nostalgic for it, but I was also trying to process things that had happened to me or that happened to my friends and figuring out, you know, how that affected me and how that kind of changed the trajectory of my life. And then when I started to think about it, I started an exercise. I actually created this method to get the raw material for characters and events and situations. I had to start from somewhere. And so what I started with was analyzing my own experiences. And I started doing something that I called memory mining. And basically it was sitting, you know, with a notebook, quiet. I actually used a friend of mine's cottage in Vermont to do this. And just like sitting on the deck, cup of coffee, the notebook, and just closing my eyes and remembering back to these various events. And so I had, I write down, like, you know, the big fight with my girlfriend's father. Okay. So let's put that down. So I put that down and I couldn't remember the details. And here's the thing. This is what I'm getting to. What I learned is the best way to get at the details of what things sounded like, what they looked like, what the light was like, you go after the feeling. If you remember the emotion and dig into the emotion and try to let the emotion of the moment come back over you, it's like those other things are encoded in the emotion. Yeah. And once I started doing that, then I was able to say, like, okay, what happened between me and my friend in this event? And then I would do that work. I would start to think about it. And I would think about the emotion of, like, you know, why did we have that fight? Or why did this person have this reaction? And I started to find that the more I did that, the more I focused on the emotion, the other things would come out, you know. So I'd start to understand wow. somebody actually said, you know, what they looked like. The point is that I started with this memory mining, and okay. that became my first draft. And then as the drafts went on, gradually it went from this memory mining exercise into actual characters, that starting with Avery Craig, who is the centerpiece of the story, and all of his friends and girlfriends growing up in suburbia in upstate New York, a fictionalized community called New Netherlands County. And there was no one moment, Jim, where I was just like, oh gosh, I'm gonna write a coming of age novel and it's gonna be super long. You know, it wasn't like that. It just kind of evolved.
Well, this wasn't your first, the Bodaciously True series of 9 books wasn't your first like this. You also wrote the Dakota Stevens mysteries.
Right.
And how many books were in that series?
That five. I you know, I published those between 2012 and 2011 and 2015 or so, 2016. And the thing is, I had an epiphany around 2015, Jim, and the epiphany was, you know, as good as these novels were, the Dakota Stevens mysteries, I said, you know what, Chris, the world doesn't need another mystery novel. It doesn't need another PI novel. It doesn't need another thriller. And I was just like, you know what, man, as an artist in general, I think, but especially as a writer, your prime time for working is between 40, like your 40s to your 60s.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, this is the prime time. This is when it all comes together. The experience, the knowledge, the fact that we're, you know, not wasting our energy chasing women, et cetera. You know, it's, you kind of settle down in that department. This is when it all comes together. And I said to myself, you got to write something that has meaning for you. And forget the genre stuff, you know, just stop doing it. And look, you know, the thing is, the Dakota Mysteries, it was so easy for me. I mean, these, you know, I can walk down the street and have half a dozen ideas for a mystery plot. No, I mean, seriously, you talk to my wife. I mean, I just came up with one the other day. You know, it involves AI and AI becoming sentient and, you know, turning out a bunch of records on somebody and framing somebody for a crime. And, you know, and I'm like, yeah. I could have Dakota and Svetlana, my detectives, go solve the crime, but I don't want to write that stuff anymore.
You're like, I'm done with that business. I want to back up to Nelson Mandela for a quick second. It always seems impossible until it's done. How long has that quote been on your wall there? Or how long ago?
Well, it's been on this wall since 2019. So it's been about 6 years. But, you know, before that, I had it in my notebooks for a long time. You know, okay. I'm kind of a collector of those. The other one was by John Steinbeck, who wrote in his, he wrote a journal about the writing of East of Eden. And he has a quote. He said, "You can't train for something all your life and then have it fall short because you're hurrying to get it finished." And I keep that up there as a constant reminder, because the temptation is so strong. You know, the creative tension becomes so strong. You know how it is. You're getting near the end of a project and you're like, I just want to get this son of a bitch done. I just want to finish it. I've got to get this thing finished. But that's the temptation. The problem is you do that, you're hurrying to, you know, get it finished. And Steinbeck's idea is, look, you don't train for something all your life to rush it at the end. Don't rush it at the end.
Gosh, well, I forget exactly what it said, but decisions that you made. And going with the quote, it's so brilliant because, like, you're conscious about it. You have that quote and you're, like, aware that that's the statement.
I think the corollary to that is from your episode 75, which I listened to a little bit, your wife made the brilliant statement about how young artists need to be willing to make mistakes. They need to be willing to screw up. And I couldn't agree with that more. I think that's the other end of the spectrum. You know, you get to this level where you have to prevent yourself from rushing to finish things because you've developed this muscle toward finishing. You know, you start something and you finish it. But on the other end of the spectrum is a saying that I've come up with. I've always said, perfect is the enemy of finished. And I think that is the problem that a lot of young artists have, whether they're musicians, whether they're sculptors, painters, writers, etc. The problem they have is they want to do it perfectly right out of the gate. And that's not how you learn, man. And if you try to do it perfectly right out of the gate, you're never going to finish anything. And it's in the finishing of things that's how you learn. That's how you progress.
Wow, man. So my wife and I have a three-word phrase that we use all the time, and I've really adapted it. Progress, not perfection.
Exactly, man. I mean, really. Yeah, I think that, you know, that's the thing. That's a very strong idea for our generation, you know, a generation that is, you know, remember, we had to wait a week before the next episode of the A-Team came out or Dallas or whatever. It was once a week. Now, you could set up your VCR to record it, but
VCR.
There was no binge watching. There was no binging. We had to be patient, you know, analog telephone. Yeah. You got to dial that number, you know, one, two, you know, so.
By the way, timeout. By the way, for those of you listening, that's the noise the phone made after you turn a dial.
Exactly. I know. I can't. I'm gesturing here, and I know this is going to be audio, so.
No, that's funny because you were gesturing, and then I did the exact same thing. I'm over here. The other thing about that, the party line where you pick up the phone and like your neighbor's on the phone. Did you have a party line?
I never did. You know, there are certain things that our generation experienced that are, I think young people are probably looking at our generation. Some of the things we talk about, like we're from Mars. I mean, seriously, how do you explain a party line?
Which is also crazy because what are the kids today in 30, 40 years? Like, how are they going to understand their children? Because it'll be so far removed. Like, once we're dead and gone, like, it's going to be, we're moving so quickly into the future. But I wonder if it's always been that way. Because you think about, like, before World War II, and I read somewhere, I heard that basically after Henry Ford, once the automobile became easily to buy and cheap or whatever, like, everybody had them within 10 years, and the horse and buggy disappeared. And I think we're moving so much faster than that. Like the cover of your first Bodacious book has a cassette tape on it.
Right.
You know, and they're long, and I thought they were going to be forever. Like, these are the coolest things.
I've got to say, you know, my feeling, having spent more time, a decade, in the years 1985 to 1987, I can tell you that I've been back in this time, literally. It wasn't perfect, but the big X factor that we didn't have to deal with, our generation as teens didn't have to deal with, that the teens today grow up with, is the internet. It's the internet, it's social media, but the big one is, Jim, it's the instant communication. Now, you'll remember when we were kids, if something happened in Vietnam right now, we weren't going to hear about that instantly. Might hear about it the next day. You know, it's a little piece on the evening news with Tom Brokaw or something, and you know, they mention it. I remember Chernobyl. You remember when the Chernobyl explosion happened? They didn't have any information. What they did was they ran those graphics with the nuclear symbol, and it's like radioactive. The point is that today, the amount of information and the instantaneous nature of it, I think that's what we were shielded from. You know, a terrible flood happens in Bangladesh. It's awful. But we weren't being bombarded, barraged with that on a daily basis. And I really feel for the young people growing up today. We had such freedom. It was nice not to know about some of these things, you know?
Yeah, you give me a ton here that I want to mention this. Man, it's so good. Back to emotion, like you talked about, the tapping into the past is really tapping into the emotion of that experience, that moment. And I agree. And it's also, wow. So you talked about that emotion to get into the 80s. So I think that's like, that's so powerful.
Well, you know, I mean, I agree with you, man. That's the thing that's been surprising to me with the advanced readers that have expressed either in reviews or writing to me. One of the things that's surprised me, Jim, is that it's not just people our age getting that emotional experience about the 80s. I've had older people who have read this as test readers or reviewers, and younger people, they all say it takes them back to when they were a teenager, and it not necessarily in the 80s.
In the 80s, just when in their teenage life.
Yeah, I mean, people who were teens in the 50s have said to me, God, it took me right back to, and they start telling me these stories about people they grew up with, and this character reminded me of this character. And that all came out of the emotion, I think. I think because what I was really trying to do, Jim, was I didn't want this to just be true about the 80s. I wanted this to be emotionally true, to kind of capture that universal experience of what it is to be 16, 17 years old.
Right.
In any time.
You know, and the funny thing is the biggest part of the 80s, like the big movies of the 80s, for me at least, was the teen movies, 16 Candles. Yeah. And so a lot of these big Breakfast Club, like big teen movies, you're writing this sort of teen experience novel. But I think about the teens today, in like the 90s, they had teen movies. Even in the early 2000s, they were teen. But I'm like, there's no good teenage movies or teenage stories of this generation, and maybe that doesn't come until like later on and looking back. I don't know. You mentioned the quickness of the delivery of our news and how that impacts us.
Well, yeah, you know? I mean, especially as an artist, man, you know, most people don't understand the sensitive nature that you have to be an artist, and to be subjected to, you know, this superfluous or this just negative vibes, man, to just get all of this negative news and crap
all the time.
You can't deal with it. You know, I know I can't deal with it. And that is why I've kind of chosen to cloister myself for the past 10 years.
Well, let's talk about that. When I first read that you did that, I think that's very unique as well. But when I first read it, it made me think of that movie, Somewhere in Time. It was
exactly
Superman. What was his name? Christopher.
Yeah, Reeve. Christopher Reeve.
And I love that. I saw that movie as a kid, and I was like, that concept is brilliant. And I've never really tried to do it, but in a way, you've gone back in time.
Well, in a way, I did do that. You can't see it now because my wife, after a while, made me take them all down. But I had this room, you know, it was like the scene in A Beautiful Mind. You remember that movie where he's got all the crap hanging up and the strings going between them? And so I had, you know, Heather Locklear posters. I had Ronald Reagan, Rubik's Cubes. You know, I had all of this. I surrounded myself with all of this stuff to remind myself. I was basically just trying to insulate myself from the outside world.
Okay.
You know, so I did that so that I would have ready access to the details that I could then put into the novel and then give readers, especially readers our age, this trip back in time to the 80s, you know. And one of the things my wife has remarked on is it's the details that I capture, like remembering us having to change phones. You get a call on a phone and like, hold on a second. And then you run, you put it down, you run into your room, and then you run back and you hang it
up. Mom, hang it up.
Yeah, exactly. Get off the phone, you know, stop listening to my conversations.
Yeah.
All of those details, I've worked all of those details in the novel because that's the kind of thing that takes you back, you know, we forget that stuff. We forget that stuff. We forget that we drank out of garden hoses. You know, you forget that stuff. It's like,
oh man. Yeah, I did. As a kid, I drank out of the hose. Absolutely. 100%.
We biked without helmets. I mean, you know, no helmets. If somebody was wearing a helmet on their bike, you'd think they're a total weirdo. I mean,
pussy.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to say it. You did.
You can say it. You said your novels are not YA, so I imagine there's some.
They are not YA, man. It's language. It is. There's no way around it. I have a no holds barred presentation of teen sexuality. I mean, they're episodes 2, 4, 5, and 6 are pretty hot and heavy. And the reason I did that, and I'm going to tell you why, I'm going to defend this once and I'm going to do it now.
Okay.
The reason I did that is because just about every teen novel, and I've read a lot of them, just about every teen novel, every coming of age story glosses over sex. And it's bullshit. It's bullshit. Okay. It's not a realistic presentation of teen life because the bottom line is for most teenagers, burgeoning sexuality was a major part of our lives, you know, in one way or another. And, you know, finding your sexual identity, pair bonding, learning the difference between lust and love. And these are the kinds of things that Avery, my central character, and his friends, you know, all start to learn to varying degrees, you know, throughout the 9 books.
You talk about Gen X, and I wanted to, something you had said made me think about whose childhood and teen experience had been scandalously absent from American literature. You talked about that were overlooked, misunderstood, neglected, a generation who, as teens, were largely unparented. And I read that and I was like, he's 100% correct. And I've heard people say Gen X is the lost generation. And I'm like, okay, what does that exactly mean? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ernest Hemingway kind of used up that, or it was actually Gertrude Stein who said of Hemingway's generation, you were all a lost generation. So we should be using a title, a moniker more like that, you know, to describe our generation. I've come up with a couple of alternatives. I mean, one that I came up with is the trickle down generation, you know, where we kind of get the trickle down, you know, we got the trickle down of the economy, we got the trickle down of wisdom, we got the trickle down of parenting. The other one I came up with is the free and feral generation, you know, where many of us were pretty free. We kind of ran feral and did whatever we wanted, or, you know, certainly fewer restrictions than kids have today. But, you know, in general, I think the freedom that we had and the being underparented or outright unparented, Jim, I think it was a double-edged sword. Okay. You know, I think that there are some ways in which it really scarred some of us, but there are certain ways in which, you know, our generation, we're pretty damn good at just taking care of ourselves. And we know how to do stuff. We know how to fix problems. You know, I can't tell you how many young people I've met, you know, like, I'll give you an example really briefly.
Okay. All right.
Across the street from us a few years ago during COVID, there was a couple, and the day they moved in, they had a flat tire, and I saw them out there on their phone trying to figure out how to change the flat tire. Okay. Yeah. Cut to 5 years later, they're moving away and they're having trouble with one of the cars again. They're on the phone trying to figure it out. And the point is, if they couldn't go to the phone, they just didn't know how to do things. I mean, I'm talking basic stuff like how to jump start your battery, you know? And those are the kinds of things that, by and large, people of our generation, we picked up, or, you know, we had our friends show us, or, you know, we just had to figure stuff out for ourselves. Right, and right. I think that the helicopter parenting that a lot of these kids coming up today, Gen Z, have received, it's actually done them a disservice, you know, because our generation got the benefits of having to figure stuff out.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I got so many things again, and we skipped over the sex part, which
keep going.
But I want to get back to that. But I will say about the parenting. Okay. So do you have kids?
I don't. So,
okay. So, you know. So you and I can't talk about this. I don't have kids either, but
I've got 50 teenagers that I've been living with, whose decisions have plagued me for a decade.
Well, I'm thinking about people of our generation who have kids, or most of them are already grown in college and have kids of their own. So I'm not going to say we're grandparents, but you know what I mean? We're in that age range where we could be.
Yeah.
But how do we raise our kids? And then how are our kids raising their kids? You know what I mean? Like, we created that. And so we were unparented. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, because many of us were so unparented, which, unparented goes back to, we got to go out and play outside till the sun went down, and our parents had no idea where we were, what we were doing, what we're up to. But then,
The pendulum shifted, and you know, our generation started to, if I had just been nurtured more,
there it is.
You know, maybe if I had had more structure, you know,
more love.
Yeah, exactly. More love. Listen, man, I think every generation does this, right? You know, we all are like, oh, it could have been better. And, you know, this was good about it. This was bad. The fact is, it just is, you know, it just is.
Well, then this moves forward to today. And you were talking about the couple across the street using their phone. The first thing I thought was the fact that they don't know how to change a tire, as being that age. But then the next thing I thought was, how brilliant is it they can just pick up their phone and get the answers?
I know. I mean, that's the thing. It's It, the internet giveth and the internet taketh away. I mean,
it's a cruel, evil bitch.
It's seriously, I think that my issue with it is it's really not the internet itself. It's the corporations monetizing people's attention now, mm-hmm. you know, designing these apps, designing their software, designing the experience is all centered on taking your eyeballs away from that thing and putting it on their thing, keeping you there, you know. And that's and I got to tell you, as somebody who would shut his phone off all day long over the past 10 years, I never had my phone with me, and I did not have internet access. Well, I wrote the first drafts. So you see those typewriters in the background? I have 20 typewriters, and I used one of those, you know, a different one about every day to write the first drafts, you know, because I don't want the distractions. The typewriters never come to me saying, you know, you need a software update, you got to update the firmware.
I will admit that in high school, we had typing class with typewriters, and
right.
But going back to the couple and the phone, like, on one hand, it was great, but then it, I hate to say this, but it makes it stupid. And I think about this, and I just had this conversation a couple episodes ago with a gentleman in our age range, and it made me think of GPS. And you took it even further back, which I never considered, but GPS makes us stupid when it comes to knowing directions. You know, you follow GPS, you don't have to pay attention, just follow GPS. And I had a personal experience with that, where I went somewhere, followed the GPS to get there. It was the first time I'd been there. And then the second time I went back, I know the city, I've been living there for a long time, but I used GPS. And the second time I used it, I didn't have my phone or whatever, and I couldn't remember how to get back there. Like, now it's happening much faster. We're talking about ChatGPT and AI, and AI is like the next level of making us stupid, because we give everything over to the machine. We don't have to learn these things. We don't have to learn how to change a tire.
I'm going to tell you what I think the number one threat of AI is. Okay. Now, let's dispense with the stupid talk about this idea of AI becoming like Skynet. You know, it's going to launch the missiles. Okay, let me tell you something. As an experiment, my best friend, Jason Scott, he's kind of an internet celebrity. He introduced me to AI about 3 years ago. And so I've just kind of casually in the background, you know, when my writing day is done, et cetera, if I've got some research questions or something, you know, I've kind of experimented a little bit with, you know, go to AI and ask it a couple of questions. I can't tell you, Jim, AI, and I, you know, would use ChatGPT, Claude, a couple of the other models. More than half of the time, it was outright wrong. Wrong. I mean, I'm talking wrong. I'll give you an example. I said to AI, I said, look, there's a scene in the novel Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, in which Anna is getting off of a train carriage in a blizzard, and there's a piece of metal clanging on the roof. And I said, could you find that passage for me? Tell me where in the text it is, what chapter and line, etc. And at first it came back with, well, sir, there is no such passage. And I'm like, dude, it's there. Okay. I've read it. It's there. Trust me. Okay. I've read it multiple times. It's there. Go back and look. Oh, yes, sir. You're exactly right, sir. And here's the premise. Here's the passage. My concern is, once people of our generation, people who actually had to read books, watch television, absorb this information, pre-internet, pre-computers telling us the answers, once our generation passes, who's going to know what the real truth is? Over time, I can see AI selling people on the idea that Anna Karenina does not have that passage in it. That, you know, Independence Day is not July 4, 1776. It was July 7, 1776. And if everybody who lived in the analog era is gone and people are going to AI for these answers, and they're just taking these answers at face value, not only are people going to be, you know, dumber, they're just going to be outright in the dark about history. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that people are going to be in the dark about.
Well, you know, okay, I got to throw a couple things out there. And you said this earlier. You said, man, was it a book you're talking about? No one reads this anymore. You're kind of relating Bodaciously True to another story, and I don't remember what it was. Wow, that was...
The Odyssey?
Well, you didn't say The Odyssey, but it made me think of a conversation I had with Don Rodriguez. He's a music producer in Vegas, and he was saying, oh, no one reads The Odyssey. Like, kids today, they don't know The Odyssey. And we were talking about that. I was like, hey, man, you're right. Like, people don't read that. And then I saw, and this may be the answer, Christopher Nolan's next movie is The Odyssey, comes out next year. And I was like...
I had that. I've had this idea for 10 years. Okay. So I beat Chris Nolan to the punch here. Okay. Bodaciously is basically The Odyssey during the 1980s.
Okay. Bringing it back around. I like that.
Yeah.
And you say that the story of Ace takes place over about 2 years, 85 to 87.
Right. Yep.
Do the events in the book are the events that took place in those 2 years, or is it more of the 80s condensed?
It's their flashbacks to other periods before 1985, 1987. But they're basically, the idea is that Avery's arc follows the arc of those seminal events during, for example, 1986, you know, the Challenger launch and explosion, Chernobyl, Reagan's imbroglio with the Iran-Contra, you know, the Contragate, the garbage barge in 1987, the Berlin Wall speech.
New York City, right? Off of New York City?
Yeah, that barge went off in early 1987 or late 1986, and it went all down the coast of the U.S. and South America. It finally got to Belize, and nobody would take our garbage out of New York City. And so, you know, it ended up coming back to Brooklyn in August of 1987. I remember watching that on the news, and all the seagulls around me. Can you imagine how much that must have smelled? I mean, a barge of garbage. Disgusting. I mean,
oh man. So it takes place during those 2 years, and a lot of the events that happened in those 2 years, and then, but this also goes back to the instant data. So,
yeah, it's instantaneous, and the half-life of ideas and interest in things is milliseconds now. You know, it's milliseconds. Yeah. You remember when we were in high school, like, oh, this is the new big movie, right?
Yeah.
That stuff would last for, you know, a couple of weeks. I mean, that, you know, like when Top Gun came out, you know, I'll never forget it. That it was mania. It was mania for like 2 weeks. And
yeah,
you know, when a new album would come out, you know, Van Halen's dropping a new album. Oh, you know, it's like 1984 came out. And I remember that was months of just hardcore interest. It's like, wow, we're going to talk about it. We're going to play it. We're going to go buy the new singles.
Thriller was years.
exactly. And today, I mean, today, the half-life of any idea, any app, any, you know, Snapchat thing, any video, it's seconds.
Yeah. Speaking of the time, it's a time crunch. And speaking of that, is that you talked about AI having these hallucinations, and it made me think of MapQuest, or maybe think of going back to driving. And the first MapQuest would always get the directions wrong. And yep. then so people switched to Google because it was better. And then like Apple came out with their Apple Maps and it was always getting the directions wrong. And people were still using Google because mm-hmm. it's better. And then, but now it's fit, like it's fit, maps are fixed. And it, you can, I use GPS to drive around sometimes if I need to go someplace and I don't worry about mm-hmm. it telling me the wrong way to go. And AI, just less than a year ago, AI had a problem. Graphical AI had like the 6-finger problem where it couldn't make hands really well. Sometimes you would have extra eyes mm-hmm. or whatever. It was had a really hard time with anatomy, which made me think of going back 50 years to Walt Disney and animators. They had early animators had a hard time with hands. Like it was hard. That's why animated characters had 4 fingers. It was hard to make opposable thumbs, but eventually we figured it out. AIs, they figured out the 6-finger problem. Like you're talking about hallucinations. Mm-hmm. It's either going to stay wrong or it's going to figure it out. Like it goes faster and faster and faster. So this advancement in technology, you even talked about earlier about the progress, not perfection. And it made me think of Apple and Microsoft. Microsoft just, they're famous for putting their software out there before it
yeah.
works. And Apple holds on to it. They're never first to market. But when they put it out, man, it's friggin'
right.
blows the competition away. It's better than anything else out there. And so I don't know if there's a point to any of this.
No, I think there's a lot of point to it. Your programs aren't unknown, right? So how does this all relate? Well, I think AI is going to, it's already injecting itself into art forms. And if something is machine produced, can we really say it's art? You know, yes. is it?
Man, that's a question for.
You know, yeah. I mean, the thing is, what is art on its basis level? I think it's the communication of emotion. That's how Beethoven used to describe it: is directly communicating an emotion through music. But the thing is that what I've found in my little experiments with it is wonderful at synthesis. Okay, it can do synthesis really well, but you don't see anything. There's nothing creative coming out of it. Mm-hmm. It's purely taking all of these ideas. Let's use, you know, songs. I can digest 10 million songs written in this key and using these instruments, and I'm going to synthesize it together. I'm going to weave it together and create something new, but it's not new. It's merely synthesizing, you know, a bunch of material. This is particularly the case of in writing. If you ask it to write you a story, chances are the story will be grammatically and rhetorically perfect, yeah. but it will be absolutely devoid of animus. There's no life there. You know, there's no yeah. spark. There's no emotion. And it's the flaws, right? It's the flaws that really make the art. You know, Michelangelo famously took a chunk out of the Pietà because he said, you know, only God can make something perfect. So apparently, I've never seen it in the Vatican, but apparently there's a hammer blow on the thing. And it was, the statue was perfect. And then he just took a hammer to it and took a chunk out of it for that reason. And anything that's machine made, something that doesn't feel emotion, how can we call it art? You know, it's just a photocopy.
Yeah, no, man, it gives me so much to think about because you are so right. And I talk a lot on this podcast about the AI, and that's something that people bring up all the time. And this goes way back to the beginning of our conversation on emotion, and AI is devoid of emotion. And you use some words like animus. Yeah, there's some really popular AI songs now. And I love this is, there is this AI funk music where they've taken like 80s, I think they've done a lot of genres, but they've taken 80s like hair metal, which I enjoy, and they've right. turned it into a funk version. And it's, and I, and me that moshing those two different genres.
I will admit it's amazing. I mean, there's no question about it.
But that's just a cover, really. So it's not original. So yeah, I mean, original music that I like, have.
I'm not seeing, it's not artificial intelligence yet. Okay. It's not.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not. It's not. It's artificial mimicking. It's a very good mimic. It's a very good synthesizer. It's a very good, you know, step and fetch it guy to go out there, run out there and get me the 10 best, you know, restaurants in this city. Quickly read through these reviews and tell me, you know, what to do here. I think it's very good at that kind of analysis and doing it quickly. But again, you know, I think it's as wrong as it, as many times as it's right.
Well, speaking of emotions and art and AI, why should we care about art?
Art is the only thing that lasts. Nothing else lasts. Political systems rise and fall. Countries rise and fall. People live and die. Sports, you know, become popular and then they go out of vogue. But we're still talking about the Odyssey 3,000 years later.
Okay? Yes, indeed.
3,000 years later, we're still talking about the Odyssey. You know, we're still blown away by, and it's still there, the Sistine ceiling. Okay, you know, it's a, we're going to be listening to Eddie Van Halen's, you know, his solos. There, you know, he's kind of the Mozart of the 20th century rock, you know, and that stuff is going to last. I mean, Beethoven's music, Beethoven's fifth, the first movement, it's one of the only songs on that gold plated record that's attached to Voyager 1.
The Voyager.
You know, and the other one was the blues musician from, I think it's Mississippi, I can't remember, but there are only a couple of songs. But the point is that art, when you really come down to it, is the only thing that lasts. That's why I think it's important. You know, it's the only thing that consistently through the ages is independent of political, you know, politics, the rise and fall and control of countries. It's kind of apolitical, it's asexual, you know, it's kind of off on its own in its own little universe. And for that reason, and the fact that it's universal, it's able to bypass a lot of these conflicts that we've had over time. And people save the paintings, and you know, people save the sculptures, and you know, people write down the music, they write down the stories, they keep the photographs. That's why I think it's important.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. And you're right. I agree with 100% of that, of course. And there's a lot we can continue to talk about. And I know I try to keep this around an hour. So, and your whole self-publishing, we haven't really talked about your self-publishing, Chris. Have you always self-published from day one?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I had opportunities. I was given a couple of offers from legacy publishers with the Dakota series, but you know, the terms were entirely in their favor. And beyond that, you know, I would have to endure, you know, these stupid talk ideas like, you know, could you make this character a man, or could you make this character a woman? I actually had one editor say to me, it'd be better if there were more explosions in this novel. And I was like, what are you talking about? Number of explosions in the thing, zero. You know, what do you mean more? You know, and listen, the reason I do it all myself is because I love the entire process. Mm. You know, that's, I'm not doing it myself because, oh, they wouldn't pick me. And no, I love the whole process. I love writing it. I love editing it. I love proofreading it. I love laying it out. I love art directing the covers. Although I didn't design them, I've art directed them, saying sure. to my designer, Victoria Heath Silk of Scotland, phenomenal designer, saying to her, listen, this is my concept. I want to have an emblematic, iconic item on each cover. And, you know, I want the name to be very bold and brash, like the 80s books were. And, you know, it comes back to, I do this myself, Jim, because, you know, I'm not indie anything. I'm self-published. I'm self-motivated. I'm self-disciplined. I'm self-effacing when I need to be. I'm self-directed.
It's all about the self.
That's the bottom line. And I always have been.
Right.
And I just love all the aspects of this process. And the last thing I want to say to this is this. Being an editor of your own work or being involved in all aspects of the process is understood and accepted in just about every art form. Mm-hmm. Painting. Nobody came in and edited Picasso's work, okay? Nobody came in and edited Beethoven's work. Some movie directors decide to have worked with somebody else to do editing, but chances are, you know, if they're an auteur, they're more involved in the process. But for some reason, there is this meme that exists in the world of writing where someone says that, well, you can't edit your own work. Mm. And I think that's just ridiculous. I think it's, there's no other art form where somebody says that you have to bring somebody else in to polish the work or to revise it or to improve it. And I feel that if you're going to do this, if you're going to do any endeavor, if as an artist, you need to be able to do the whole process.
Yeah.
And you know, you at least have to be knowledgeable enough to know when you can't handle a part of the process and go seek out, you know, seek out help.
This leads right into, I was going to say here, self, not solo, because you mentioned it even, yeah, Victoria, the designer.
Yeah, exactly. And
so, but I want to ask you this. And earlier on, you mentioned, I think maybe you said beta readers, but you have other people to help you, but do you only you edit yourself or do you have someone else edit like
no,
grammar and things
I
like
edit,
that? Like,
I edit myself and
100%.
I'm not, it's not that I'm averse to having somebody else edit my work. I mean, the fact is, first of all, I don't want somebody else editing my work. You know, okay. Go write your own damn epic novel and edit it. Okay. You know, you spend 10 years isolating yourself and writing 1.3 million words, and you can go, you know, you can go edit it. You know, good for you. Go do that. That what I've found is that I know really good ones are out there, but I don't know them. Okay. And, but I know myself and I know my skill set and my skill set is pretty damn good.
What if it was someone who was just into to do the punctuation and make sure the grammar was correct and not change the words? Would you allow that in?
But I can do that.
Okay.
I know when the grammar is correct. I know when the punctuation, and you see, you know how I know that? Because I know that. You know,
with years of working within the industry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've got the reference, you know, I've got all the reference books, man.
So let me ask you this.
Backwards and forwards.
Did you have beta readers or advanced readers?
Well, no, you know, the not beta readers before I put it into publish form. I've had early reviewers, you know, the reviews have been good. You know,
I guess a better question is after you've had some advanced readers or early readers go through your first book, Bad Boy, did you change anything after after anybody read it, or like once you
I'll admit there were probably half a dozen of readers of the ARC, the advanced reading copy, who pointed out, you know, minuscule little errors, you know, missing a space, missing a comma, or a comma where it shouldn't be.
What about plot holes?
Probably half a dozen of those little errors, you know, that just got through my editing, proofreading, etc. Okay. But no, nobody made suggestions to me to, you know, change X, Y, Z. It's
okay.
This is the, you know, I've written quite a few plays too, Jim, and I love writing plays. I love plays. But what I don't love, I actually despise, is the playwriting. We're going to workshop this. We're going to take this thing that you, the friggin' writer, have put together, and it's good. If I write it and it, I consider it done, it's done. But not in the world of playwriting. No. You know, that's when you got to sit down and let's workshop it with the actors, you know. And
isn't the idea to make it better?
They're amazing, and they bring animus to the words. But I don't want to do that. I don't want to take my idea and have somebody else play with it. No. No, get your own idea. Make your own thing.
Okay. What about the idea of making it better? Like having someone else's, hey, suggestion. Or finding a plot hole. Oh, you missed this plot hole right here. Maybe if you did that, added this in or took this away, it made more sense. What about ideas like that?
Well, you know, I mean, I will admit my wife has been my muse for many years, and she's my first reader.
Okay.
So she's my, that is the one person from whom I get those kinds of suggestions, and I'm willing to take them from her.
Okay. It's good. Good relationship. You know,
she's a trained actress and does many other things, but her insight into like character motivation and things like blocking, you know, a scene where I have a character here and then there and then doing this little bit of business, she's been invaluable when it comes. Okay. She'll read my, you know, last draft or what I think is the last draft and go, well, you know, maybe you ought to have Avery do this in this order, or you ought to have this happen. So I'm open to that, but I have a very, very small circle.
Okay. I've done a ton of editing in my life, and I have edited our own story, our own book. But we've edited it together. I've edited it, she's edited it, and it's kind of the same thing, bouncing back and forth.
Right.
To make it better. So shout out to the partner of
think that if you can find a partner that you can work with in that way, that's gold. I mean, you know, because that it's not easy. I have tried to do joint projects with people, and you know, it's really a chemistry thing. It's got to be
absolutely 100%.
And it's got to be clear up front who's taking the lead on what aspect of the project.
Yeah. So, Chris, man, oof, lot of.
I know it's been a long conversation, man. I want to
throw out how people can get in touch with you, how they can find you. I know you're on Amazon, and if you just go to amazon.com, Chris Orcutt, O-R-C-U-T-T, double T, Chris Orcutt.
Exactly.
They all come up here. The first one is the Bodaciously True and Totally Awesome episode 1. Comes out January 20th, 2026. So for those of you listening in 2026, go get it.
And there's also my website, orcutt.net. Okay.
Orcutt.net.
So you could go there and learn more about Bodaciously or any of the other books I've read. I've got a very considerable blog on writing, and So, you know, I think there's a lot there for people, especially aspiring writers. I've had a lot of aspiring writers write to me and say that my blog has been kind of pretty valuable to them.
Web blog, right here it is. Okay, yes. And I know the detriment of the human race, social media, but I have to ask, are you on the socials? And if so, what are you on?
I'm on Facebook. It's, you know, it's facebook.com/OrcuttWriter. So okay. It's OrcuttWriter.
Orcut Writer. So we've got you on Amazon, your website, Orcut.net. We can find you.
Got your books on there. It's been a pleasure, really.
I want to ask one last piece of wisdom, bits of advice, anything, one last nugget for the Art Unknown audience.
All right. So one bit of wisdom. To whom am I speaking? Who needs wisdom?
Well, since we've kind of finished up with publishing, I would love to hear wisdom to someone who wants to self-publish. What's the best way to do it?
I think the thing is, my big piece of wisdom would be this. I think there's way too much emphasis today on nonsense like marketing books, the platform, social media. You've got to have a platform. You got to have an audience. You got to have a reader. That's all BS. Okay.
Okay.
If you have a story to tell, if you want to be a writer, you write. Okay. Work on the writing. Get into the process. Learn about grammar. Learn about usage. Learn about characterization and writing fiction. Start a project. Finish a project. Don't leave things half done. If you start a story, finish the story. Write a longer story the next time. You write a novel, don't tinker around with that novel for 10 years. Write another novel. That's how you learn. And my emphasis here, Jim, is I think too many people they want instant results. And if you want instant results, this is the wrong field. This is the wrong place to be because it takes time. But the nice thing about that is that if you put in the time, over time, your skills are going to get better. You're going to produce better work. You're going to finish more projects.
Put in the time, I think. Man, that's so true.
It really, you know, the thing is, art is labor. This is work, man.
Art.
Don't wait for inspiration. That would be the other one that I'd say. You know, I'll leave you with this. The writer of Westerns, Louis L'Amour, okay, the famous writer of Westerns going back years and years ago, he has a biography or an autobiography called The Education of a Wandering Man. Turns out he had very little formal education. And he considered his education everything he learned from books.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he said of writing, he had a great quote, and I've never forgotten it. I read this when I was maybe 21. He said, "The words don't come by sitting around for them. You have to turn on the tap, and then the water flows, and then the words start to come." So the point is that it's the act of physically writing, starting the writing, that gets the ideas to flow, that gets the story to go somewhere. But if you sit around waiting for inspiration, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. And in doing the life, living the life.
Exactly.
You even said, like, finding stories just, you know, as you go through life.
Yeah.
Like, seeing those. Man, Chris, this has been so good. I really appreciate your time. And
man, it's mutual. I really enjoyed this, Jim. Seriously.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Chris Orcutt, everyone, thank you so much for sitting down, giving us not only your wisdom, but talking about the 80s, talking about life, talking about the quickness of the internet versus of our rotary phone.
Seriously. And for you Gen Z kids, go to YouTube, put in analog rotary telephone, and you can see one demonstrated for you.
There you go. Chris, thank you again. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
The music for this episode of the podcast is an instrumentation of the 1985 smash hit Bad Boy by Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine. Once again, it's an instrumentation of Bad Boy to commemorate the very first edition of Chris Orcutt's novel Bodaciously True and Totally Awesome, Episode 1, Bad Boy. Get it wherever you buy your books and listen to Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine wherever you listen to your music. I am Jim Wills, the host and producer of the Art Unknown podcast, and I'd like to give a big thanks to Chris Orcutt and all my past guests. I want to say and shout out to my fans who have stuck with me throughout the years. Thank you so much for enjoying the Art Unknown podcast. Now, get on out there and enjoy this amazingly beautiful day. Take care of one another, and of course, remember to feed your soul with art.
Hey everybody, it's Tony Robbins. Look, the time is here. It's 2026, and everybody talks about having a new year and a new life. But what do most people do? They create a few resolutions, and in the end, they don't really do anything. If you want this to be the best year you've ever had in your life, it's going to take a new tool, a new strategy, a new momentum, and maybe a new community of people to hang out with. So come join me for the Time to Rise Summit. I do it only once a year. It's coming up January 29th through the 31st. There's absolutely no charge for it, but it'll be an experience I promise you, you will not forget. It'll give you momentum, a plan, and a strategy to make 2026 the best ever. If you're up for that and you're hungry for more, come join me. There's no cost for it whatsoever. Just go to timetorisesummit.com. Timetorisesummit.com. I'll see you then.